Accession number 19990, reel 8.
Chief Technician Barry Roper, reel 8. You've been describing monkey trick training. How long did this go on for, and how many outings did a particular man or subunit need before they became proficient in abseiling out of helicopters?
No, well, we used to work with different army posts. A lot of that, you see, when there was an operation on, or they knew there was activity from the Yoka terrorists in the hills, we would, as soon as you set off towards the area, the sort of bush telegraph warned everybody you were on your way. So you had to have an element of surprise. And we'd had, on each operation we did, we'd probably have 12 or 14 helicopters. And so many would set off in one direction, so many in another, but you knew eventually where you were going. And usually the area had been pinned down by observation posts with a few soldiers at each position to see that there was no movement. And then we had to, the troops would come in by road, possibly as near as they could get to the area. And of course, we would then pick them up, take them up to the mountain or whatever, and drop them wherever we could. Well, very often you couldn't land. There was sort of small hilltops and things, and you could only hover above it. And on occasion, the troops could just jump out from about 3 feet high onto the deck and carry on and go and do their work. But in a lot of cases, under the pilot's seat, coiled, was this rope with the knots in it. And we had things that they would throw the rope out and not have it fully deployed and then lean on it, and they'd end up sort of being jerked off the rope as the slack was taken up. And so it was decided, because of the injuries that had been sustained, particularly with people with rifles and Sten guns over their shoulders when they fell, we used to go to these army posts and spend sort of probably half a day just taking 10 people up to 10 feet, and they'd throw the rope out and come down it. Then they'd land and put another 4 or 5 in, because the aircraft would only take really a maximum of, the pilot plus 4 passengers, and in most cases 3 passengers, because of the weight and the heat out there. You needed all the power you could get to raise a full aircraft, sort of thing. And so we'd get them. They had to be taught about the tail rotor and the main rotor blades, how to get in and out of a helicopter, because the blades could be at sort of neck level under certain conditions. And so you had to teach them which segment of the disc they could walk into with safety. And of course you had to be careful, because some of them would get out and walk straight back into the tail rotor, which did happen. And so it was just a case of familiarising them with the helicopter, and also how to get out of it from a height of sort of 10 or 15 feet.
Safe entry and safe exit.
Yeah.
Did you ever practice doing this sort of thing under fire, as if you were coming under enemy fire?
Not me personally, but in certain circumstances, the helicopter took people into where the terrorists were pinned down and there was fire going on. But normally the helicopter would be sort of kept, because they were quite valuable to the army, they were more or less, it might be 100 yards from where there was any activity going on.
Was it then an accepted principle that you would deplane before you got into the zone of the firing?
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm. So it's the same kind of thing with motorised infantry, isn't it? They get out of the truck before you.
That's right. Of course, later on, I can't recall any helicopter in Cyprus suffering from bullet damage. In the areas they operated in the trees and whatnot, you quite often sort of damaged the blades because it was such a tight landing and so on. But I don't think any came under serious fire.
Could trees and vegetation do serious damage to?
Oh yes, because the blades were wooden blades with a brass leading edge, and if you clip the tips often got damaged. There was a, if you can imagine the way a model aeroplane is built with ribs and spars, the end of the blade was an aluminium tip, and the leading edge of the blade was brass segments about 3 or 4 inches long all the way along the leading edge, and quite often you hit the tips. And if it was just the tip, then you could change the tip. But these things were finely balanced, and if you damaged one blade, you had to change all three. And blades were at a premium. There was a very short supply, and having to do tracking and balancing was quite a lengthy process. Then you had to air test afterwards. But we had occasions where clipping the trees... the repair that we did to the damage was with midaplin, the fabric taped up the ends of the blades with the fabric and dope, and flew the thing back very gently because it was out of balance, out of track, and it sounded from a distance when they heard us coming back. It sounded like a railway train with the blades not following the same tip paths, you see. But the only alternative would have been to sort of leave the aircraft where it was, and it wouldn't have stayed there long. They'd have blown it up or destroyed it.
You said balancing and tracking. Yes. How did you get blades and so on balanced so they're on exactly level track?
The blades came in sets of three. And what happened was, without complicating things, you set the head to zero and put the blades on, and then for each blade there are certain settings, so you do adjustments to what the manufacturer had said, and then with a flag on a pole, the aircraft was started, the blades were engaged, and at two speeds, the pilot would give you the okay, and you'd turn the flag into the track of the blades, and each blade on the tip was marked with chinagraph pencil or chalk. When it hit the flag, you had, say, a green blade, a red blade and a blue blade. You could see which was the highest, which was the lowest and so on, and the idea was to bring them all on top of one another so it was a perfect track. And once you'd done this,
how would you do that? Did you put weights on them?
No, on the rear of the blades, on the trailing edge of each blade, there were two long tabs. The inner one was the balance tab, and the outer one was the tracking tab to get the tips right. And what you'd do is you could use your thumbs and fingers, or there was a tool which was just a block of wood with a slot cut in it that you put over the tab, and you bent them. And then you'd do another track until eventually you got all the tips within an acceptable strike on the flag.
This is really a trial and error process.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, you're messing about. Sometimes you could bring two blades up to the... to the one at the top, or you could bring the top one down and the bottom one up to meet. And when you'd got it tracking correctly, then you had to try for the balance. And to balance the thing, it was very difficult. We used to have a block, a balance table, which was just a block that clamped round the pilot's control column with a flat top. And onto this you put a piece of paper, and then with the pilot running the aircraft, what we did was just hold a pencil on the piece of paper, and because the stick was stirring, you'd get an ellipse drawn on the paper, and if this was outside the limits, you then had to do to adjust the balance on the blades. And to do this, you took one blade and you put a big weight on it up on the head of the rotor head, so that you knew you'd thrown it out of balance. You'd then run it again and you'd take a trace on the plate with your pencil again, and that would be the red trace. And then you'd move your weight to the green blade and you'd do the same again. And when you'd unbalanced each blade in turn, you then saw the greatest trace and the least trace, and those you calculated which blades had to be adjusted up and down on this tab again, the balance tabs, until you got the state where the pilot could run the aircraft and his control column remained virtually with a very little stir, not anything. And then we had the problem of going flying, because having adjusted these tabs, you could end up where they had a situation which was called throwing on or throwing off pitch, and most helicopters throw off pitch. In other words, the collective pitch lever, which alters all the blades, this is the up and down pole that he has, if you leave go of it in flight, it will immediately drop down and you'll go down. Now, the ideal thing is that he should be able to leave go of it and it should stay where it is. And for a pilot who's flying to have to hold this lever and knowing that if he leaves go of it, it's going to fall, go down, and he's going to go, it'd be constantly, well, it would give him pains in his forearm and things just holding it. So we used to have to adjust the tabs collectively to make the collective lever it would probably be 2 pounds to push it down and 4 or 6 to pull it up, and that was sort of an acceptable figure because it was always lighter when it was throwing off the pitch. And this was a lengthy process, and you probably have to do 2 or 3 flight checks to get it right. And once it was right, then you're all right for a little while until the next blade failure or what.
Did blades fail anyway as a result of use?
Later on, in other parts of the world, because of the humidity and things, there were blade failures. But you got blade damage, either cracking, but it was through misuse or through violent manoeuvres of the aircraft at times. Quite often they'd hit the fuselage with the blade. If you stop a helicopter in high wind, it was always dodgy. We used to have to, at times, and this was unheard of, we used to have to taxi a helicopter into a hangar to close it down, because had we closed it down in a strong wind, the blades would sail and they'd start to bounce as they slowed down. They'd bounce and they'd hit the fuselage.
Or the wind caught them.
Yes. The thing is revolving fairly slowly,
yes.
And then all of a sudden the blade would lift up and then it'd come down again, and it either hit the boom or it hit the top of the cockpit. And on the top of the cockpit there was a leather pad where the windscreens join the roof. There was a leather pad, but it used to hit this leather pad, but it had hit it with such force there were screws holding this pad on, and the screws would scribe lines across the blade. And of course once the finish had gone, then that was another set of blades. And also, of course, in handling helicopters you often hit the blades on hangar doors and vehicles and all sorts of accidents like that, although it was a very serious offence. Because of the lack of replacements, you were likely to end up in a lot of trouble if you damaged a blade.
You mentioned the tabs that were used for balancing.
Yes.
Blades. What were the tabs made of? Were they also wood or were they something
else? No, they were a very... it was a stiff metal. It had the appearance of lead. And if you can imagine, it's just a metal bit on the trailing edge of the blade, and there were two of them. One approximately 2 foot each long by about 2 inches wide, And they used to overhang the rear, the trailing edge, by about half an inch. And usually you could go along on the balance tabs. You had a special gauge, which was a dial test indicator, which had a three-legged mounting. And on the blades, on the underside of the blades, there were a series of painted yellow dots, which the feet of this triple-footed mounting, you'd hold it up to the blade, and you could get a dial test reading on the inner tabs. And this was to make sure that you hadn't bent the inner bit of it
too far
and left the other bit the same. So you had this gauge check, which was, once again, time-consuming. But once you... Once you'd got into the habit of doing it, it was, people used to take a pride in getting the balance absolutely spot on.
It sounds as though the tabs were made of something like printer's metal.
They weren't soft. They were.
Well, printer's metal has got a certain hardness, hasn't it?
I would think it was mild steel, to be honest. It might have not been magnetic. I wouldn't think it was able to be magnetised, but it was quite stiff. And when you bent them, you bent it slightly more than you needed to, because it used to come back on itself. But also, of course, the blades were very flexible. You could have on certain conditions, a blade would bend and it would be within 2 feet of the ground at the tip. And then, of course, when it's flying and you're in a descent with the blades holding the weight of the aircraft, the blade tip would move through about 10 feet, and the blade would be curved. If you see a helicopter in the hover, the blades on the Sycamore weren't straight. They were bent with the tips. Yeah. And so these tabs had to be fairly flexible, because the whole... rotor blade was sort of able to go through quite a distance.
What sort of wood were they made of?
I've a sneaking suspicion it was spruce. The where the blade joined onto the fuselage, to the rotor head, it was a circular tube with a boss at the end, which fitted and bolted onto the aircraft. And then you had a solid laminated wooden... a solid wooden bit of the blade, which it was made with laminations, which was probably somewhere in the region of 3 feet. And then the rest of it were separate little spars covered with ply, and then the whole thing was beautifully finished. They were shiny, they were black, and you could polish them. But I think it was a sort of painted finish, because the paint used to crack where you got the flexing. You could see sort of lines in the finish.
Did you have to repaint them to keep them?
No. I believe that at second line they would probably we used to clean them, but I would think that when you put new tips on and things, that they touch the paintwork up, because the tips, as I remember, I think the tips were yellow, so that people could see them if they inadvertently walked towards it.
You're talking about the risk of walking into the tail rotor, and it's been said that some people are fascinated by the tail rotor and drawn to it. Did you ever come across any case of that?
No. The thing is that helicopters, if you're landing in a small clearing and there's troops waiting to get on board, usually the troops would put out a small indicator to show which way the wind was blowing, because if we didn't know, we had to be into wind, and more often than not, we had to keep the engine running with the blades turning, because either it would be gusty and we're likely to suffer damage if we closed down. But when you get into a clearing, you've got trees and so on, and the crewman on board would be telling the pilot that there's a bush near the tail rotor, and the pilot would have to move with his rudders to move his tail rotor away from the bush. Well, of course, when you've got troops hanging about, you might be turning towards the troops, and to try and sort of get them to move or to go into a safer area, you know, they can't always appreciate that you're going to be swinging the tail about. And but most of the danger was when either somebody came in from the rear to go to the cockpit, and they didn't see the tail rotor. Your mind is on where you're going and what you're going to say when you get there, rather than what's this thing that's causing all this draft. And we had occasions where troops got out, and instead of running out at 90 degrees to the fuselage, they ran back down the fuselage and straight into the tail rotor.
But that was not because they were drawn by it, it was simply because they were trying to get away from the aircraft.
That's right. And obviously, at these times, these people had a lot more on their minds. Either they were going and they were probably going to engage the enemy, or they had to get to a certain place to do a certain thing. And of course, they just weren't thinking. And it's easily done. I mean, I've seen qualified airmen that have been on aircraft for years walk into propellers.
Simply because they weren't thinking.
That's right. Just mind on other things.
You mentioned that you could have possibly three fully equipped soldiers on Sycamore, perhaps four, if you were lucky.
Yeah.
Insert any substantial force, you'd need a number of aircraft operating simultaneously, wouldn't you? How many machines do you normally have delivering troops in one go?
The squadron had a total of 14 aircraft, of which two would be on standby. So we'd probably... our job, basically, if they knew the Ioka terrorists were in a certain location, our job was to take in... about 30 troops and position them to pin the enemy down until troops could be got in larger numbers by vehicle and have to trek possibly overland. And so we would sort of they'd know, somebody would report that they'd found a fire in the hills where it shouldn't have been, and that somebody had breakfast there, and so on. And immediately they'd go into action. We'd drop the troops in so that the terrorists would go to ground, and then a bigger force would come up by road, and they'd completely surround the area and start a sort of fingertip search, more or less, because it's fairly rugged country. But these people were in caves and hideouts, but they were fairly successful.
Did you ever actually see any terrorists yourself from
the machine? Oh yes, there was an occasion where we were operating on one of these schemes, and they were on this hillside, and a corporal went into the bushes to relieve himself. And lo and behold, a rifle barrel came out of the hole that he was relieving himself into, and he was shot. So the troops withdrew, and we knew they were in the hole. And there was a brigadier there in charge of the operation, and he said, right, stand back. And we had a Cypriot interpreter with us, and he said, tell them to come out with their hands up and throw down the weapons. If not, we will get them out. So this went on for a while, and two of them came out and gave themselves up. And the brigadier said, "Well, it was on a hillside, and he scraped a channel in the sort of sand and what have you. And he said, right, get some fuel, aviation fuel, from the helicopters, which was Avgas. And he said, tell them, if they don't come out, I'm going to fill the hole full of Avgas and throw a match in. And they actually poured this fuel down into the hole. Anyway, they got a bit fed up, so they weren't sure how many were in this hole. And they sent the one of the people who'd given himself up, they sent back in to explain what was happening, and, you know, that they'd die. And he went back in, and it never came out. They started firing, trying to shoot the way out. And when it was all over, and I didn't witness sort of all this, I was with the helicopter, it was Axe and Diu. And Axe and Diu, if my memory serves me right, there's a big memorial to him in Nicosia. He was a Greek army officer, a professional soldier, and they said that he was killed by a ricochet from his own gun, but actually he shot himself when they threw the match in.
So they did burn them out?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the other occasion, we had a...
How many of them were there in the hole, do you know?
I think there was about five, of which two came out, one went back. I think there was only one that stayed out. But it was, we had two brigadiers out there in my day, Brigadier Baker and Brigadier Butler.
Yeah.
But this brigadier, he walked around. I can remember him because he had a stick, one of these sort of Scottish-type walking sticks.
A thumb stick.
Well, it was taller than a...
You have a thumb, you put a thumb in it, yes.
But... I think Axe and Diu, in fact, I've got books that might well confirm this bit of the story. If you want to, I've got two or three books on Grievous and Eoka, and there will be references. The other big, you see, on our crew room wall, we had a wanted poster with probably 30 photographs of known terrorists. And all of them were wanted for escaping from such and such a prison. They'd all been in prison. And as you went along, there was red crosses as they caught up with them. But there were a lot. I mean, Grievous himself, and they came very close to catching him, but never managed it. But the one that... we had a situation where the troops were in an ambush position on a hill... And we moved in, sort of, they had observation posts and so on. And this hill was thoroughly searched. But during the night, one of the lance corporals had he'd made a mistake of some sort. And so as punishment, they said, right, you will do another night on this hill. And they moved off to do the next hill. And this... chap that was doing this sort of punishment on this hill that was clear, he ran straight into one of the most wanted terrorists of the lot, and they opened fire, and the Marcus Dracus was the terrorist, and they sort of panicked, and they shot and shot and shot round after round after round. And this chap, apparently, Marcus Dracus, cleared two or three stoppages in his on his Sten gun before he was eventually sort of dead. And we went up there to see what had happened, because it was only by chance that they'd left this corporal to do this additional sort of observation that they caught Dracus. And
he must have thought that everyone had gone when the rest pulled out.
Yeah. And they walked straight into one another and sort of stopped and realised what had happened. And as I say, Dracus, they tell me, he was the only one that we had any respect for, because he was a brave man. But most of the others, it was sort of hit and run, you know, you didn't have much respect. Grievous himself, of course, considering his age, you had a certain respect for him, but...
What happened to the corporal, then, who was engaged with